Hey, everybody, welcome to Locked On Lakers for Friday. Brian Kamenetsky and Andy Kamenetsky. And Andy, we've told people since we engineered our coup and took over the show that we'd be trying to bring in some great guests and some great voices onto the program. And there are none greater, perhaps with the exception of Slava Medvedenko or Von Wafer, than the great Howard Beck of Sports Illustrated. He's joining us today. We'll get to that in just a second. I do want to let you know that today's episode brought to you by Built Bar. Go to builtbar.com and use the promo code LOCKED15 and you get 15% off your next order. That includes you, Howard. You can go and use that promo code and get 15% off your order. How are you? It's good to see you.
I'm good. It's great to see you guys. I'm going to put you on hold for a second while I go enter that code.
That's fine.
They might run out and then I will.
No, man. Built Bar, they know the demand. They understand it. They've got plenty. You can finish the interview. Right, we promise you're not. We'll have HQ send you a bunch of Built Bars if, in fact, they do run out. But that just doesn't happen with a company like them.
I appreciate that reassurance. Thank you for the nice intro. I thought that was leading to, we promise you we get some great guests. Having failed in that regard, we didn't have Howard.
I mean, we did fail to get Slava or Von Wafer. I'm not going to lie. But
you're third.
Yeah. I mean, only behind those two.
There are a lot of people in the world.
A career scoring for the Lakers, I think I'm not that far behind them.
Well, behind don't get us started on those two. We love
I said
both,
scoring, so not field goal attempts, so that's right.
and not feel good moments either. Well, because you're talking to somebody, my fantasy team is named Slavon Waferdenko, so it gives you an idea of my affinity for those guys. There's no question.
That's a little frightening.
All right, so we got a ton of stuff we want to cover with you, Howard. And starting with, you know, like the news, like LeBron is, they think, coming back next week. That could be, you know, technically the week starts on Sunday these days. So, you know, that could be Monday against Denver. That could be Thursday against the Clippers. But he's coming back reasonably quickly, it seems like. What have you made of this time without him? Like, you know, they haven't won a ton of games, but I, in my opinion, haven't lost as much as I thought they would.
I mean, listen, I think that when he first went out, I think, you know, there were legitimate fears and speculation that depending on how long this took, is he going to come back and they're going to need to fight their way, not necessarily into the play-in range, but like, are they going to be ninth or 10th? Are they going to be facing single elimination in the first round? Or, you know, slightly better case scenario, are they in the play-in, period? Are they in the 7 through 10 range? And it wasn't unreasonable to think that that could happen. And as we sit here right now, they are two games up on 7th, and so look reasonably secure in being a guaranteed playoff team and not having to go through the rigmarole of winning a couple of or winning one play-in. So that's good. I mean, look, no team loses. No team that's built around two superstars, especially with the way that the NBA's cap is set up, right? If you have two max guys, chances are the drop off from them to the rest of your team is pretty steep, and the Lakers are no different. And if you lose both of those guys, we could reasonably expect that you're going to be a pretty, you know, mediocre to bad team. And I think they've come through this in a lot of ways better than expected, at least better than the worst case scenarios. And so it's fine. I have said all along, and I firmly believe this, when you talk about like where you are in the standings or home court advantage or seeding and does it matter and all these things, the answer is different for different teams. And in the Lakers case, it doesn't matter. They're the Lakers. They have LeBron James and Anthony Davis, and they're the defending champions. And though there are a few guys on this team who haven't done it all, seen it all, the majority of them have done it all and seen it all, and the majority have done it, in fact, together. So I don't think it's critical to have home court. I don't think it's critical to get the right matchup. The West is really tough, and you don't want to set yourself up for a route to the playoffs that possibly includes, you know, three of the best teams, whichever three you might want to throw into that equation. But if you're the Lakers and you've got LeBron James and Anthony Davis, like you're not worrying about any of that. You're the Lakers. Like, seriously, I don't want to, you know, get too far into Lakers exceptionalism, but if they weren't coming up,
that's exactly what our audience wants to hear, Howard. So, I mean, you're only endearing them by going the exceptionalism route.
I do not mean to pander. But I truly mean that you could change the team name to whatever, the Cleveland Cavaliers, a team that once had LeBron James. Any team that has LeBron, and especially if you're coming off the championship, I'm not going to worry about what your route is. That's just fundamental for me. I'm sure that we could find some exception to that, but I think in general, as long as they are healthy, they'll be fine. I do have a couple of caveats to that, but we can get to that.
Get to them.
Okay. All right.
We've reached the caveat portion of the show anyway. This is naturally where we insert them.
Is the caveat portion sponsored by anybody in particular who have a discount?
Also Built Bar.
Okay. The caveat is this. If he's coming back, like we've been on LeBron watch, it's imminent for at least a week, week and a half already, right? So by next week, we're down to what, 6-7 games, mm-hmm, maybe for the like Lakers?
That, yeah.
That's fine. That's enough time for LeBron just needs to shake off whatever bit of rust there is. He's LeBron. He'll be fine. Anthony Davis is shaking off the rust. He's getting better by the game. He'll be fine. The caveat is this, though. Andre Drummond is not just a new player that they picked up, but a significant new player and one who presumably is starting all the rest of the way. And they threw a Ben McLemore into the mix. And it's not that these are huge adjustments, but they are adjustments. LeBron James and Andre Drummond have never been teammates before. Like that's something you got to kind of like, if we're going to talk about in this league that rhythm matters and chemistry matters and practice time matters and training camps and all this, and when a team falters, sometimes it's because they were missing some pieces of this. Then we can't just pretend it doesn't matter at all just because of the Lakers. There are limits to even my Lakers exceptionalism. So I do think that to the extent that LeBron and Andre Drummond have to find some sort of rhythm, and the two of them and Anthony Davis have to find a rhythm, and like that's real. It's these things aren't automatic. You know, guys like the ball in certain spots, you know, you get a sense of you know, a player's individual preferences and rhythm and, you know, mm-hmm, places on the court, all this stuff, like those things matter. It doesn't mean that it's a huge obstacle, but it's something. And so they'll have just enough time to kind of get a feel for each other and then jump into what might be a really tough first round series. So, I think that's at least worth flagging. But overall, you know, if LeBron comes back and is 100% and has can get at least 4, 5, 6 games under his belt, you know, individually he'll be fine.
That actually leads me, though, to one of the main things I did want to ask you about with this team, because it's been a great source of tension and consternation on Lakers Twitter, and that's the fit with Davis and Drummond. What do you think in terms of, like, the potential upside with them, the potential issues with them, like how well they can make it work, how well they even have to make it work?
Yeah, like it's hard to kind of, first of all, it's hard to read too much into the sample size we have so far because LeBron hasn't been there. Like, mm-hmm, nothing that you can experiment with, nothing that's new that does not involve LeBron can be that meaningful. Like, it's nice for them to be on the court together and kind of figure some things out and, you know, how they're playing off of each other and all this. And, but LeBron makes everything work. And so there's no substitute for that. So how that will all work out, you know, the other piece of that is that once LeBron is back, then, you know, Frank Vogel at some point has to kind of figure out that big man rotation. And how often are Anthony Davis and Andre Drummond even on the court together once they're at full strength? Because, you know, they've got all these different options.
Particularly right? Down the stretch of games, you know, where that's typically when they will play AD at the five. And they're not going to ruin that just to make sure Andre Drummond plays.
No, especially when he's on a short contract. And, you know, like, yes, you got to make sure you keep guys like, you know, Bill Orme just had a great piece about, you know, the just potential chemistry concerns and ego concerns with all these bigs. And, you know, they'd gone through that, of course, a season ago. The quote from Montrezl Harrell and Bill Orme's follow-up paragraph about Montrezl Harrell was hilarious. Go read it in The Athletic, folks, if you haven't yet. But the idea that you want to keep these guys on board. You want to keep them upbeat and happy and satisfied with their roles. But, yeah, end of the day, their best center, and this was the case a year ago, too, doesn't matter how much you were getting out of Dwight Howard or JaVale McGee, your best center is Anthony Davis. And their best center now is Anthony Davis. And their best closing lineup will often probably be with Anthony Davis at the five. And we won't be talking about his fit with Andre Drummond because he'll be clapping.
But clapping great. Clapping like a two-time All-Star.
Caveat.
Yeah.
I hope he's clapping. If not, then they've, you know, maybe they've got issues with chemistry and ego bruising, right? So.
Once again, the caveat section of today's show brought to you by Built Bar. 15% off with Locked On in the code. Get them before Howard does. You talked a little bit about the matchups and how they don't necessarily matter, but there are some interesting ones that we want to get into. And we also, this continuity question, which you mentioned with the Lakers, is kind of consuming Lakers fans. But it's not unique to the Lakers. And I want to ask you about how it's impacting everyone else around the league, you know, the Nets and on down. We'll do that next.
Locked On Lakers brought to you by Bet Online, the fastest, easiest way to bet on all your sports action. Baseball season is in full swing. You can track all the action at Bet Online this week. Tons of sports action on the go. NFL draft is on. The Kentucky Derby is back. The first leg of the Triple Crown begins this weekend. Get all the latest news, odds, and info on your sporting needs, including MLB, NBA, NHL, UFC, MMA action. Before the next pitch, head over to BetOnline on your laptop or mobile device. Check out all the great sporting news, sign-up bonuses, contest information. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore, as this is your chance to get back into the game as the teams prep for their runs to the playoffs. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit when you use the promo code LOCKEDON. Again, the promo code LOCKEDON. Bet Online, your online sportsbook experts.
So the Lakers, they've had zero continuity. They're going to get zero continuity, but this happens with every team and their fan base. You kind of focus on everything that's going wrong with you, and you assume that nothing is going wrong with everyone else. It's like Facebook. you only see the best parts of everyone else's lives. Is what's happening with the Lakers that much worse than what we're seeing around the league with other contenders? You know, Denver's lost, you know, Jamal Murray and has to reconfigure everything really quick. Brooklyn hasn't played any of their, you know, really hasn't played the big three together at all. Yeah. How much worse are the Lakers than everyone else right now in this regard, in terms of the continuity question?
Like the misfortune index or something.
Yeah.
I haven't looked at it that closely, but you know, there's been some talk recently just about that the teams that have had the best seasons in large part have been healthy, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Suns have barely missed their best players at all. Chris Paul and Devin Booker have played, you know, 99% or whatever. The Jazz have not really missed much. I think Donovan Mitchell recently a little bit, and they, you know, and then Mike Conley at one point, but Gobert's been there, I think, throughout. So the teams with the best records in the West are teams that have had their best players healthy the whole time. Even, you know, I saw somebody doing this analysis and they were noting that like the Knicks health-wise have been one of the healthiest teams, especially with regard to their best players all year. Now, their breakthrough season is for a lot of different reasons. It's not just health, but that has been a huge benefit compared to some of the other teams in the East, especially the ones that we're looking at as underachievers like Boston, Miami, Indiana, even Charlotte, because LaMelo Ball was having this phenomenal year before he goes down. Like, there's been a lot more injury and volatility. The Hawks have had a ton. So the teams that the Knicks have been able to leapfrog, in large part, it's because they've been screwed up. In the West, I mean, look, I guess really the question becomes like, who are the Lakers reasonably most worried about, or who are Laker fans most worried about on behalf of their team? You know, the Nuggets without Jamal Murray is a pretty big deal, though they've played great without him. And the Aaron Gordon pickup looks that much more important, even though that's not the same position, but just having mm-hmm. a certain, you know, level of talent. You know, the Clippers, it's the usual dance, you know, with them, you know, Kawhi's out, Serge Ibaka was out. Like it's so like they've got continuity issues. How seriously are we considering the Suns and the Jazz? You know, I mean, there's a certain, for most of the season until Jamal Murray went down, I think we were all still kind of looking at this as, well, the Jazz and Suns are having nice seasons, but it's still all about the two LA teams in Denver. I think that's changed a little bit. And I really like, I have no idea how to read this this race.
Okay. two elements with that specifically, Howard, that I want to ask you about with Utah and Phoenix, because I think, as you correctly note, they are the two top teams in the West
that seem to be getting the least amount of odds in their favor, faith in their ability to win a championship. So two elements of that specifically. Phoenix, with their overall inexperience, other than Chris Paul, Jay Crowder in the playoffs, and then Utah, the idea that Rudy Gobert is somebody that you could either play off the court or, if nothing else, play into a position of disadvantage, depending on how you configured your own lineups trying to go smaller, you know, particularly a team like the Lakers, that even their small versions of themselves are big enough. How much do you think those factors matter with Phoenix and Utah in terms of them being true contenders?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in some of the unwritten laws of the NBA, right? Like, experience matters. Teams don't generally go from lottery to contender overnight. Mm-hmm. They do if you just added LeBron James and Chris Bosh in 2010, right? Like, that's a different version of this. The Phoenix Suns did not add LeBron and Chris Bosh or anything equivalent to that. They did add Chris Paul, an older Chris Paul, and he's still phenomenal. But there wasn't some overhaul here. There wasn't like some, they didn't just build a super team from scratch. They took the same basic group and grafted on Chris Paul and Jay Crowder. And the results have been fantastic, and all credit to Chris Paul, to Monty Williams, who's, you know, one of the leading coach of the year candidates, and to Devin Booker for kind of adjusting his game, handling the ball a little less, and just all of them, you know, they've all made strides. So they're legitimate, and you don't get that record with even in the regular season without it. But do I think that the axiom still basically holds that a young team needs to like take its lumps first? Yeah, I do. And this is a strange season on every level anyway. So it's harder to really assess, like, what does it mean? What does that record truly mean? And the advanced stats on them are all great too. And, you know, you can look at their net rating, their offensive and defensive ratings, and then a lot of other elements that point to them being legitimate. How are they going to do under the searing spotlight of the playoffs? Now, the searing spotlight is not the same searing spotlight, right? Arenas are not packed. I don't know at what point they will be. I suspect we might get there sometime in this postseason, maybe. But if we think that youth is partially about experience under the most difficult circumstances, the most pressure, part of that pressure is being on the road in a hostile environment. How hostile is an environment with 2,000 people in it instead of 20,000? So
I guess it probably depends on who those people are.
Yeah, 2,000 people in Utah can still make it pretty nasty.
The right, like, people.
Those folks are salty, man.
It's a bad Salt Lake joke there somewhere.
I think you just made it.
Damn it. So somebody workshop that. Do a better version. I gave you the raw material. I think you can still, like, you can manufacture some of that atmosphere, and I think teams have been really creative about that. And you can also, you know, you can use the volume button, right, on the PA system. But it's not the same. It's just not the same. And so does that by whatever percentage does that lessen the degree that their inexperience and youth matters in a playoff series? Maybe. Devin Booker's also he and Chris Paul are kind of co-stars, but Devin Booker's kind of like the offensive engine of that team, right? Devin Booker, as the most important scorer creator on that team, he's been in the league long enough that I don't think he's going to be intimidated seeing LeBron James lining up across from him for the first time in a postseason. Like, I just don't. Devin Booker looks like he's tough as nails to me mentally. And I think that, you know, that team plays with a certain confidence and swagger that maybe Chris Paul has imparted to them on some level. I don't think those things are going to matter as much. They matter because they've never played in the playoffs. But does it matter as much? I think less.
And, you know, and get to Utah in a second, but the Clippers too, it's like, does the order matter here for the Lakers? Because, you know, inevitably you would think the Lakers are going to have to play the Clippers at some point to get to the Western, to get to the finals. Does it matter if you play them first? Because if you finish sixth, you play them probably first. Yeah. If you finish fifth, you probably don't play them until the conference final. You in theory would go Denver in the first round, definitely Denver in the first round, then probably Utah. And then the Clippers. Does it matter when you get them, do you think?
to the extent that the Clippers are still trying to find their rhythm because of Kawhi absences, Ibaka long absence, Beverly mm-hmm. absence, adding Rondo late in the game, maybe you can make a case that getting the Clippers early is better. That maybe the Clippers they're not settled yet, right? Even more than the Lakers, they are, well, at least as much as the Lakers, they are having to kind of reestablish their rotation and roles and all of that because they've been missing guys and they have a significant new piece in Rondo. And Rondo's a more significant new piece for them than Drummond is for the Lakers, because Rondo at his best is he's running the show. He's settling guys down. He's getting guys in the proper places. Like, the ball's in his hands. Andre Drummond is a piece.
But there's no such thing as playoff Drummond, though, Howard. That's the counterpoint. Like, I understand what you're saying, and
most literal sense, has there ever been a thing called playoff Drummond?
I think he's been. I believe Andre Drummond has been in the playoffs, but you know, Frank Vogel used to tell us all the time last year that Rajon Rondo's value could be measured in swag. To the best of my knowledge, Andre Drummond's swag meter, undetermined. We don't know it yet, Howard.
Can I find that on Second Spectrum? Is that on Cleaning the Glass? Which advanced stats site that I need to subscribe to?
I've never met him before, but Ben Falk does not strike me as a swag measurer. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I could be jumping to conclusions.
We should ask him. By the way, eight career playoff games for Mr. Drummond.
There you go. Yeah, Brian. How do you do? I have Google. I could look this up myself, but
never been out of the first round. So
that gets he's played on some crap teams. I'm surprised he's been there at all. Yeah. But that gets to what I was saying before. Like, I think the reaction that most Lakers fans would have to the question of, do you want the Clippers early or late, is, oh, no, the Lakers are too disorganized. You don't want the Clippers early. That's like a death matchup in the first round. Forgetting all of the stuff that you're talking about. The Kawhi's been in and out of the lineup. Paul George has been banged up. They got Rondo. Pat Beverly's not there. Like, they've got all the same problems that the Lakers do.
And I think it's a bigger deal when you're talking about, okay, when the playoffs start, if everybody's healthy, is it Pat Beverly or Rajon Rondo who's starting the game? Is it Pat Beverly or Rajon Rondo who's finishing the game? You know, Beverly's, you know, proud guy and has been part of that team since before they got the stars. He was part of that, you know, that 48 win team that, you know, gutted it out and made them attractive enough for the stars to come. And, you know, he brings a certain element to the court that I think that team really values and likes. And I think, I'm trying to remember, I thought I heard somewhere recently that that the preference there is that they would rather have, that Lou would rather have Beverly start when healthy. I think I saw that somewhere. Maybe I hallucinated that.
But we'll aggregate it either way.
Sure. Yeah. Why not? report :
Howard Beck potentially hallucinating.
that's every day. But that's a thing.
Howard Beck before coming down.
I would be more concerned. Again, I'd be more concerned about when we're talking about like ego bruising and guys feeling good with their roles. Like, I'd be more worried about the Pat Beverly, Rajon Rondo balance on the Clippers side than I would about the Andre Drummond, fill in the blank, you know, Marc Gasol, Montrezl Harrell, whatever, decisions on the Lakers side.
All right. So lots more that we still want to get to in our last segment with Howard, including questions about Frank Vogel and whether or not he's actually going to get any Coach of the Year love. Doesn't come up a conversation. We'll do that next.
Locked On Lakers is brought to you by Built Bar, the best tasting protein bar ever. The bars are covered in 100% chocolate, soft, easy to chew. I am not going to say the ones that are not easy to chew, those bars, but they know who they are. Built Bars, healthy, great for the health conscious person, whether you're trying to lose weight, maintain weight, but still want to indulge in some fun treats. Low calorie, low sugar, high protein, high fiber, great for keto diets, and even more deliciouser than before. You got the 12 original flavors like raspberry, coconut almond, salted caramel, banana bread, 6 new flavors, including cherry barcia, lemon almond cheesecake, cookies and cream. They're perfect for someone like me because I love basically every taste on the planet. I love new, different combinations, experimenting, even some stuff that might sound a little weird, but all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I can't believe that blended like that. You will never get bored eating the same thing over and over with Built Bar. Go to builtbar.com, use the promo code LOCKED15, and you'll get 15% off your next order. Again, promo code LOCKED15 for 15% off at builtbar.com.
All right. So, yeah, is Vogel going to get any love here? Because it seems to be a two-person race with Monty Williams, you know, Tibbs, maybe other people. Maybe it's more than two people. You know, Quinn Snyder, people talk about.
Other things you should have Googled before bringing that up.
Right. Two or more.
It seems to be a two-person and or a host of others race.
Right, right. Today's math segment brought to you by Built Bar. 15% off when you enter Built Bar into the locked on, into the code. But does the Vogel deserve any attention here?
I'm not going to answer that question because it's unfairly phrased. I object, Your Honor. It's not whether or not he deserves it. It's the coach of the year race. Like in any given year, there are probably 7-8 guys who deserve to be discussed, to be in the conversation. Is he in the conversation? I think he's in the conversation. He deserves to be in the conversation. Who's in the conversation? We like talking about the conversation. That's more about MVP than coach, but it applies there too. The thing with the coach of the year is as soon as the Jazz established themselves clearly as a team that went from good to great, like Quinn Snyder jumped up to the lead of that race. And then the Suns, who we all expected to go from lottery to cute little first round playoff team that would finish somewhere between sixth and eighth, suddenly became the second best team. Now Monty Williams is there. So in January, it was Quinn Snyder. By February, it was Quinn Snyder or Monty Williams. And on any given week since then, you could probably go back and forth. And then somewhere along the way, the Knicks went from, hey, they're kind of fun. Oh, hey, their fans finally have something to be happy about. Too bad they're going to lose their lottery pick. Ha ha. To, oh my God, the Knicks are really good and they're not going away. And so now Thibodeau is in there. And, you know, you could pencil in any of those three guys into the top spot or put them in any order you want among the top three. And I wouldn't argue. And I don't know how I'm going to fill it out myself yet. But I feel like those three are really clearly ahead of the field because of the combination of how surprising it was. We do. There's a lot of that, right? Coach of the year. Although I will say this, it feels like coach of the year is one of those things where we say, oh, whoever completely defied expectations or defied expectations the most, there's something to that. But if you look over the last 10 years, it's mostly guys who were on who coached one of the top two or three teams. It's not like we are overlooking the coach on the best team in the league in favor of the guy who surprisingly got his team from 10th to 7th. It has in fact been mostly coaches of teams that were among the best in the league. And though, you know, two of those, Monty Williams and Quinn Snyder, fit that profile and they fit both parts. Their teams exceeded expectations. They don't have the most supreme talent. These are not super teams. They're dominating a conference that has, there are no super teams except for, you know, the Nets out east, but like there aren't that many teams that have like supreme talent at more than one position. So those guys stand out. Tibbs stands out. I've heard people make a case for Steve Nash, given that, okay, yeah, it's a super team, but he hasn't had that. They've had 7 games with all three of those guys and they've changed up their rotation a zillion times and had to experiment a ton along the way. So I've heard people make the case for Nash. I don't think he'll be on my ballot, but I just throw that out there. I'm trying to think of who else we're missing here. Glancing at this. Oh, Doc Rivers.
That's your anti-Canadian bias coming through.
Clearly. And Doc Rivers, he's the other one. So those are the 5 names that I think have been bandied around most often. Let me turn it around on you then, guys. You're the Locked On Laker podcast guys. What's the case for Frank Vogel, especially given the strength of the field that I just mentioned?
I think it is highly underrated. The act of coaching superstars is completely underrated. It is harder than people give it credit for.
Agreed.
They were playing very well when they had those dudes. But then I actually think it's how they played without them. They've been a middle of the pack team without their superstars and a very ordinary and very limited roster because it's built around LeBron James and Anthony Davis. you know, the defense has stayed at the top of the league despite missing Anthony Davis, their defensive player of the year candidate, who is supposed to be the anchor of it, and LeBron, who is the other really good defender, playing guys like Harrell, you know, and moving other guys in and out of the lineup. I actually think he's shown his value in how they played without those guys. So in a kind of a perverse way, it's the ordinary play without the superstars that reinforces, I think, the type of job that Vogel has done. And I'm also biased because I think that the work of coaching superstars is way harder than people give it credit for.
I agree. I was going to look up too. I was trying to remember how much support he got last year. Did he get any votes?
He was fifth. He finished fifth.
Okay.
Which I think would surprise a lot of people actually, but he did end up finishing fifth.
Yeah. Right. That's mostly an award for not being shanked by Jason Kidd.
Cause I thought he deserved a lot of credit last year. I mean, this is also one of those cases too, where, and you know, and people will do this, you know, after the fact, whether it's, you know, fans, bloggers, whoever will be like, you look at the final results and you say, and you think, what, Frank Vogel only got three votes, or how could he not have been on more ballots? But it's like, well, we only have three slots, folks. So, if I thought Frank Vogel was really good, but not quite as good as three others, then it's not that I didn't like him or respect him or the job he did. It's just like, there's only three slots. And if there were five, then maybe he would have been at four or five. And if everybody had, you know, like this is my argument for expanding the MVP ballot that I keep getting mocked for, which is that, there are a lot of guys in the conversation, who are nevertheless not really worthy of the top one, two, maybe three slots, because the highest standard is for those top slots, right? Absolutely dominant regular season individually and great team record, because that's always been part of it. And so that's the first year. And then like fourth and fifth are like slots that you reserve for, you know what, Chris Paul, he doesn't have the stats of a Joel Embiid or a Jokic or a Giannis, but the impact he's made on the Suns, I want to recognize that. I'm putting him in at fourth, even though Kawhi Leonard has better stats also on a contender, right? But so you have to start making these trade-offs, like which thing are you valuing most in fourth or fifth? And so, and this is why I say we should go maybe like seven slots or something else, because then you could have still like the dominant guys who earn it based on the usual qualifications for MVP. And then you still have a couple of slots for, I want to recognize that like this guy, like a Julius Randle, because people have thrown his name out there too. It's really hard to get him on the ballot, but, and so coach of the year, it's the same thing. It's not that guys are getting overlooked. It's that there's just only three slots.
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned Randle, because you are in New York. You have for years covered New York basketball. You have your finger on the pulse of New York basketball culture and have for a decade plus. Who is more popular right now in New York, Julius Randle or Kevin Durant?
Given that I rarely leave my apartment and have not been in, like, you know, sports bars, restaurants, arenas. No, like, listen, this has always been a Knicks town. Duh. Like, that's not just, you don't need a Google search for that one. Although I do recall like 10 years ago, somebody had done, it was like Google heat maps. I don't know if it was based on searches or based on whatever. And it showed like the Knicks have like every zip code within the five boroughs. And there was like maybe one little piece out in Brownsville or something that was Nets instead or something. I mean, the Nets have been here since 2012 in Brooklyn, where I live. And there was, you know, there certainly have been times when you see a lot of Nets gear around, especially on kids. Cause like it's, you know, that's the team they're growing up on, right? That's the team up the street. But their parents all grew up on the Knicks, and the Nets were in New Jersey, and nobody cared about them in New Jersey. I'm old enough to have been at you know, Lakers Nets finals in 2002 when they couldn't even sell out the Meadowlands for games three and four of a very sad sweep. That was just like a profoundly awful series to cover.
It's like paying to go to your own funeral, Howard. I mean, there were reasons people didn't want to buy tickets to that.
Fair, but it just, the Nets have just never had much support. So the fact that, like, it's really unfortunate for the Nets that the timing of all this is what it is, right? They signed Kevin Durant at a time that they know that they have to skip a year with him anyway because of the Achilles. And then by the time he's ready to play, there's a once in a 100-year pandemic that, so he ends up making his debut in front of, you know, an empty house. And then they trade for James Harden. Now they've got the reigning super team in the league. They don't ever play together, though, because the three are never on the court at the same time because of health and other issues. And there's now there's starting to be fans in the building, but not that many. If there were ever going to be buzz or momentum or a groundswell or any sense that the Nets were like carving out their own niche, or to answer Andy's question, that there would be more people walking around talking about and wearing Kevin Durant gear than Randall gear, like this has happened at the worst possible time for the Nets to get that ideal payoff, and it may never come. Look, is there still a ton more Knicks support in this city than Nets? Yeah, of course. Does the fact that the Nets have a chance to win the championship, but the Knicks are now relevant again, like the scales are tipped to the Knicks? The bar was lower. The bar was lower partially because Knicks fans are more ingrained and just more numerous. And because, the Nets just still don't register on that level here.
Randall 1, Durant 0. That's all I took from all of that. Randall 1, KD 0.
I've always said that the Lakers, for example, that's part of it. He's a great guy. I love Julius. But like the Lakers will always be a bigger story locally, no matter how bad they are and how good the Clippers are. Even as the Clippers can be a big national story. The Nets are a national story, but not a local one. I mean, like, that's just the dynamic at play here.
Well,
that's okay.
No, but I'm glad you brought it up because, of course, I've worked in and lived in both markets, and it is a very direct analogy. Other than like the Nets have more obstacles than the Clippers in some regard. You know, the Nets, and when they were in New Jersey, were not considered a New York team, even though it's just across the Hudson, right? They've been in the city itself for less than 10 years. The Clippers at least have been there for a few decades. Granted, were managed like horrifically, but they've at least been there long enough for people to decide, I guess I'm going to root for these. I don't want to root for the front runners. I'm an underdog guy. I want to root for these guys. The advantage that the Nets would presumably have is that because New York's, I think there are more distinct identities within boroughs and neighborhoods here than there are in LA. And I say that, I feel like I'm qualified to say that having lived for 7 years in Hermosa Beach. But it's just different. Like if you're from Brooklyn, you're from Brooklyn. You don't say you're from New York. You say you're from Brooklyn. Like it's a different thing. And so that identity, and because there's, two and a half million people in this borough, there's at least the concept that, well, maybe identity wise, you'd rather gravitate toward the team that has your borough's name across the front than New York. That's a nice theory. It hasn't worked out that way so far, but they haven't been here that long. And they've only been good for pieces of it. And the first version of the team that they had here, their super team, can the people in the podcast audience see me throwing up my air quotes? The super team they had with Darren Williams, Joe Johnson, and Brooke Lopez was the most boring, good team I've ever seen in my life. And so they just haven't been able to make that kind of headway. So the Nets have the advantage of there being a Brooklyn identity, and maybe that helps long term. The Clippers don't have that, because even once they're the Clippers of Inglewood or whatever, I don't know that's going to give them some advantage based on region, based on location.
Probably. No, if anything, it's going to have people in LA saying, why don't you just go all the way to Seattle? Like that's going to be
or Orange County or something. Yeah.
I said this during the height of Lob City, or maybe toward the tail end of it. And I was out there covering a series, and I remember talking with Plaschke about this, about how like on the LA Times website, like the Clippers weren't even on the drop down menu at that point, I think. like
Jesus,
or they were really low on it, or maybe you had to go down to other or something. And so
just below Loyola Marymount,
were they in a metro section? Like
I think it was in the classifieds, but, but the thing was during the Lakers leanest period, while the Clippers were at their best and the gap between them was as large as it's ever been in the Clippers' favor, they still couldn't really make much, headway, carve out a niche and get the attention. And the same thing happens here in New York, where, you know, you judge it often on the back pages of the tabloids, and the Knicks just have to be competent to be on the back pages of the tabloids. Or when they're spectacularly dysfunctional, as they often are, they're on the back pages of the tabloids, and the Nets could be good and they're still being ignored because they're the Nets and not the Knicks. And the Knicks generate more interest. And so it's very much analogous. But at the height of Lob City, I do remember saying, maybe in that same conversation with Plaschke, like, they are, as you just, one of you just said it, a bigger national story than a local story. And if the Clippers at that time had been in Seattle, they would have been a huge story because they would have, they wouldn't be, have been overshadowed by somebody in the same market that, you know, that has the kind of legacy that the Lakers have. And it's the same thing with the Nets in a sense. Like if the Nets were in Seattle, their profile would be very different. There's something to being in a market where, you know, you're just overshadowed by Big Brother all the time.
All right. Before we let you go, Andy and I know, like, look, you go way back with the Lakers. You've got some stories. You covered some of those, you know, those great three-peat teams. You probably get asked daily, hey, what's your favorite Kobe story? What's your, you know, tell us a cool thing you did with, what about that time Shaq lifted you up and spun you around like a top? Or it's like all that. We're not going to do that. What we want is your favorite Slava Medvedenko tale.
We're so insanely jealous that you got to cover him, Howard.
Slava,
like we were around, him at the tail end a bit. You know, we struck up a couple small convert, but I mean, we weren't around him on a daily basis, soaking up that essence like you were.
Wow, a Slava Medvedenko story. That's tough. Slava was not much of a talker. Slava was not much of a talker. I think I did a feature on him at one point. Because the Lakers really thought they'd found something, right? Like this was, this was early on in that era of like, find the you know, hidden gem in the international market, you know, where they hadn't like plumbed every last, like, and so at that time, you know, everybody's trying to find, you know, the next Dirk or something. And I think the Lakers really did think they had something with Slava. Like they were patting themselves on the back there for a while. I have some vague recollection of like, you know, did he like he had an advisor or an agent or somebody who also maybe owned a florist's or something? Like some weird. I'm trying to remember. There was somebody I needed to reach out to do this story, like somewhere deep in the LA Daily News archives. Google like Slava and florist, and I like again. I could also just be hallucinating, but I have this vague recollection. And then like my lasting memory is like just Slava getting the living shit kicked out of him by Rasheed Wallace in the 2004 finals because Karl Malone couldn't play. So
he was a little in over his head in that one.
Well, that's why, you know, it's funny because the narratives out of the 2004 finals is always about, you know, the Pistons and their three musketeers, four musketeers, all for one, five musketeers. They've got a lot of musketeers that they're all for one, one for all, plucky underdog thing, overcame the big bad Goliath Lakers with their four superstars, Hall of Famers. And like, there's like some truth to that in the outline, but it's like the details kind of mattered that year. And the details were that Shaq and Kobe wanted nothing to do with each other. And Kobe was gunning and had like the worst field goal percentage of any playoff series he'd ever been into that point. And was just ignoring Shaq entirely at times in that series. Gary Payton was pouting the whole way because he didn't like the triangle and he didn't like Phil. And Karl Malone was hurt, and he was probably the most important out of those four because of what he represented, and he was kind of a glue guy, and you didn't have him there to deal with Rasheed, which left you with Slava Medvedenko.
Because they also didn't have Horace Grant. And he was also hurt.
Right, and like everybody, like Fox, Devin George, I think, like everybody was banged. Like the supporting cast had just disintegrated. And so... And Kobe and Shaq wanted nothing to do with each other. So it was never as simple as like, oh, the plucky Pistons and all their various musketeers beat the big, bad Hall of Fame team. And also there was the idea that, like, oh, that just proves that you can't have these four big egos and there wasn't enough balls to go around. Like, no. Again, if they were all just simply healthy, and then actually it wasn't about four guys that couldn't share. It was about two, the same two that they'd had the problems with the whole time.
Well, I mean, that Pistons team, in retrospect, was not really lacking star power. No. Like they just weren't seen as the Lakers. Like they have like multiple all-star appearances, Hall of Fame guy. They weren't quite the little engine that could.
Exactly. And they just hadn't gotten that recognition until then. But after that point, they got a ton of it because then they were established. It's just that it just happens to be the timing of when they broke through, and they did have a phenomenal chemistry, and they got, you know, they each kind of figured out who they were at the exact right time in their careers with each other. And yeah, like it all looks much different in retrospect than the themes of that series were at the time. The other thing though is this: Rashid doesn't leap off the page, but I will go to my grave saying this. Rashid Wallace was as good or great, as great as any of those great power forwards of that era. His stats don't show it because Rashid Wallace didn't want to be that guy. He could have gone for 25 and 10 every night with a couple of blocks and a couple of steals. And he could have been one of those guys who averaged like two steals and two, a block and a half, a steal and a half, and a three-pointer and a half, or two three-pointers per game, whatever. He had the ability to play inside and out on both ends, and was incredibly talented and one of the smartest players that you've seen. He just didn't have the stats to show it. So part of the skewed view of the Pistons is that because Rashid didn't have the stats, because he chose not to, he rather would just be like a guy, like he wanted to always make the right play. He was a guy who just liked being a great teammate. He did not want to dominate the ball. So he never had Chris Webber's numbers or Duncan's numbers or Garnett's numbers, but he was as good as any of them. And so that team was just basically misassessed.
The great Howard Beck from Sports Illustrated likely will be invited back at some point. Although this slander against Slava blaming him for the finals loss, it is a mark against you. I do have to be honest. So we'll
see.
I don't know. He took his cable knit sweaters and he went somewhere. I think he's probably in the Ukraine or in Ukraine. You're not supposed to put the in front of it.
You gotta have him on the podcast.
I'm not joking. He ran for some office in Ukraine. I'm not kidding. Wow. He didn't win.
He had my vote.
He did have my vote.
I don't care what he's running for.
You know what, though? Karl Malone would have won.
Yeah. Even in the Ukraine.
Thanks so much for doing this, man. We really appreciate it.
No, this is a blast, guys. Thanks for having me. And absolutely happy to do it again as long as I get more discount codes.
That's fine. Yeah, as many as you need. All right, we will be back on Monday with probably some mailbags, some LeBron coming back chatter and all that. Everybody have a great weekend.